Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. It's income tax season, and while millions of Americans who expect to owe money might drag their feet digging out all the necessary documents and information to file returns, millions more can't wait to file. In fact, for low to moderate income families with children, the Earned Income Tax Credit makes late winter and early spring seasons of bounty. The EITC functions both as an incentive to work and a shield against poverty, sending hundreds or even thousands of dollars to modest income households in a lump sum. Those so-called refunds can total more than workers actually paid in taxes without the stigma of traditional poverty relief measures like welfare or even food aid. So how do families put this money to use, and what are the pros and cons to federal aid that comes as a once-a-year windfall rather than a monthly allotment? Sarah Halpern-Meekin is assistant professor in human development and family studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's lead author of the new book, It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. She joins us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative, which, by the way, is examining the staggering costs of living poor through the lens of the Jubilee Park neighborhood in Old East Dallas. That series is called One Crisis Away, Inside a Neighborhood. You can find it at jubilee.kera.org. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
What is the Earned Income Tax Credit exactly? Who qualifies?
So the Earned Income Tax Credit is a refundable tax credit that's available to low-income workers. So the earned income part is key. You have to have had earned income in order to qualify. The biggest benefits are available to working parents, however. So people who cannot claim dependent children on their taxes are only eligible at very low levels of earned income and only for a very small benefit. So most earned income tax credit recipients who are getting those big lump sums you mentioned are working parents, and those are the people we focus on in our book. So the biggest benefits are available to people whose earned incomes are somewhere between $13,000 and $18,000 a year, typically. The benefit levels vary depending on your marital status, so you can have higher earnings as a married couple and still be eligible. And the amount of benefits you get rises as your income rises, then plateaus between that $13,000 and $18,000 a year. And then after your earnings exceed $18,000 a year, your benefits decline gradually, phasing out somewhere between $40,000 and $50,000 a year in earnings, depending on your marital status and how many children you have. So people with one child can claim much higher benefits than people with no children. And people with two children or three children can claim higher benefits. Above three children, there are no additional benefits for having four or five children.
Sarah, tell us a little bit about the history of this. It was first envisioned and enacted in like the mid-70s, but it has been expanded over time.
Yeah, so the original idea was to just refund the taxes that lower income families were paying. And around the same time in the 1990s that the conversation was going on around welfare reform, David L. Wood and some others in the Clinton administration were thinking about ways that we could expand supports for lower income families. So rather than just having the sort of stick of welfare reform, the punishment of taking away welfare, as it were, they wanted to create a carrot to make work more appealing, to make work pay. And they saw the Earned Income Tax Credit as a way, a pre-existing policy that could be expanded to make work pay for lower income families. So they took the existing benefit, which might have only been a few hundred dollars, and increased it. So now it was a really substantial sum of money, perhaps several thousand dollars for many families.
It's fascinating that these expansions of the Earned Income Tax Credit coincided with shrinking welfare availability, seemingly without protest from people who typically object to any kind of cash benefit for the poor.
And that's one of the really fascinating things about the Earned Income Tax Credit is how little attention it has typically gotten. There was so much attention to welfare reform and so relatively little attention to the expansion of the Earned Income Tax Credit. And I think there are several reasons for that. One is that it's hidden. It's hidden in our tax code. And wrapping your head around tax code and tax policy is certainly a challenge for anyone, and certainly much more difficult to explain publicly and to get public attention for. And the other issue is that there's widespread consensus across party lines on the focus of the earned income tax credit. You know, everyone from Barack Obama to Ronald Reagan has lauded the earned income tax credit as a great program. And that's because it's targeted at just those people who are behaving in ways that seem to adhere to prime American values. So they're working, they're paying their taxes, and they need a little bit of help getting by as they're trying to parent their kids. So the group of people who are eligible for the earned income tax credit come across as very deserving of assistance in a way that I think welfare recipients typically have not been seen.
And those same recipients feel, you know, proud of the fact that they, by their work, have qualified for this credit, and they don't feel the shadow of stigma in accepting this money in the same way that they would if it was some kind of, you know, if it was called a welfare benefit.
This is, again, one of the really fascinating things you've hit on about the earned income tax credit, is that the government has found a way to support families without stigmatizing them. So people, when we interviewed them, people would discuss welfare recipients or even time on welfare that they had themselves in the past as a really negative experience. Welfare recipients, even by former welfare recipients, are seen as a stigmatized group, as perhaps not deserving of the benefits that they receive. And people don't feel that way about their EITC, about their tax refund. They feel like they worked hard, and this is a way that we help out working parents. And so they felt good about that assistance that they received, as opposed to feeling like they had to, you know, sort of trade their dignity for a check.
Did the expansion of the earned income tax credit actually have the effect of convincing more lower income Americans to work, or did it simply allow them to be more candid about the fact that they were working?
That's a really difficult question, because there was work behavior that was going on by welfare recipients before welfare reform that was done sometimes under the table, sometimes not reported to caseworkers, because you would trade your welfare benefits for your paycheck. So it's kind of hard to track those sorts of things. I think there's some debates about whether or not it was welfare reform that led to the really drastic rise in the number, particularly of single mothers who were in the labor force, or if it was the reward of the EITC increasing around that same time that pulled people into the labor force. So was welfare pushing people into the labor force, or was the EITC pulling into the labor force? Probably the answer is that there was a little bit of both going on. We also had, you know, big changes that have been occurring over time in terms of our views of whether or not women should be working. And we've seen, you know, a long-term trend towards the idea that women should be working and should be economically contributing to the household.
It is interesting that you use the term there was work behavior going on, as if, you know, under the old system, it was something that people had to keep quiet about. With the earned income tax credit, I just want to stress this. You mentioned it earlier. The more people earn, potentially the more they can receive back.
Yeah. So with welfare, you know, if you had a job and you had earnings and you report those earnings, your welfare check would get docked basically dollar for dollar. So you earn a dollar at your job, you lose a dollar in welfare benefits. And at the phase in range, what we call the lower end of the range of the EITC benefits, it goes just the opposite. The more you work, the more you earn from your wages, and the more you get back from the earned income tax credit. So while people felt like welfare was punishing work, people feel like their tax refund rewards work.
So let's talk about this. Families come to expect that this will happen, although eligibility can shift from year to year and amounts can shift from year to year. What kinds of plans do they start making for this money in anticipation of whenever it is they file?
So those families who do receive the EITC every year certainly look forward to it and think about what they're going to do when that check comes. Some of that thinking is daydreaming. Oh, when I get that check, I could go buy this or I could go on that trip. But a lot of the thinking is also more concrete. You know, the daydreams are sort of nice thoughts we all have about what I would do when I win the lottery. But we also do, you know, we also hear people doing much more concrete planning that is much more in line with what they actually do when they get that money, which is thinking about, I have those bills I need to pay. I can finally get caught up on that debt. I've had this one debt collector calling me. I can pay that down. So people engage in that sort of thinking. But some of the daydreaming that people do is also, you know, not so pie in the sky, thinking about, well, maybe if I could save my refund this year and next year, I could actually have the down payment on a house. And so people's thinking really ranges. People are optimistic thinking ahead, but people also would tell us that they didn't want to count too much on their tax refund check because they weren't quite sure how it was calculated. They weren't quite sure what they would get from year to year. And so while people had dreams and plans, they also felt a little reluctant to put too much weight on those plans until they had that number announced by their tax preparer of what they actually were going to get back.
Do families who qualify for the EITC typically need the help of a professional tax preparer to file for it?
Many of them feel like they do. More than two-thirds of EITC recipients file their taxes actually with a for-profit tax preparer. So they don't just feel like they need assistance, but many of the people that we interviewed explained that they wanted the assurances that a tax preparer like H&R Block could offer, you know, with their audit protection plan or their slogans like you've got people or peace of mind. Those slogans really resonated with people because they're concerned about having to owe taxes. That would be really devastating financially to not only not get a refund, but to owe taxes, which very few could afford. And so they really wanted to make sure that people got that the refund was right, that the number was calculated correctly, that they weren't going to get audited, and that if they were, they had some protection. So people feel really unclear about how taxes are calculated and want some protections against the risks associated with taxes.
You note, and this is important, that the earned income tax credit amounts that people receive are typically large enough to inspire what social psychologists call future-oriented behavior. What does that mean and why is it important?
So there's been research showing that when people are living in really strained economic circumstances, they often have to focus on the here and now. So when they experience scarcity of resources, that you have to focus on getting by now. And it's really hard to sort of look up and think ahead and think not just what makes sense now, but what makes sense over the long term. And so one of the things that we see is people see all this potential in this money. The money frees them up to think about, to take that longer term perspective, to say not just, you know, what do I have to do right now, but what can I do in the future? And that's really different than what people are able to do financially throughout the rest of the year, because they do have to be so focused on getting the bills paid that week, that month, as opposed to what they could do 6 months or 6 years down the road.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is my guest. She's assistant professor in human development and family studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and lead author of the book, It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. By the way, KERA is examining the staggering costs of living poor through the lens of the Jubilee Park neighborhood in Old East Dallas. You can check that out online at One Crisis Away Inside a Neighborhood. That's at jubilee.kera.org. We'll be back to this conversation in a couple of minutes, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. SMU Summer Youth has hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration opens March 3rd at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Sarah Halpern-Meakin, Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her new book is called It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Sarah, often we hear, particularly from those who have not ever found themselves in really dire financial straits, that lower-income people tend to make poor financial decisions. What did you learn about the kinds of spending and saving and investment that tend to follow, the weeks and months after these checks come in?
So we learned that people are very attentive to where their dollars are going. So people are not thinking about their spending. They're thinking about it quite a bit. People are really aware of down to the dollar, you know, how much each bill costs, what their expenses are like. And that behavior really comes out in the ways that they choose to spend the money from their refund. So you might think that when you don't usually have a lot of money and then all of a sudden you have this big check in your hand once a year that you're going to go out and spend it on, you know, big trips or extravagant purchases. And we actually saw that very little of the money went to those purposes. So most of what we were seeing people spend their money on were things like paying bills, catching up on debts, putting some in savings, and buying durable goods, so things like a used car, a standalone freezer so that you can, you know, buy food when it's on sale and freeze it for later. So only about $1 in 10 of the refund dollars went to what we would term treats. So things like a meal out at a sit-down restaurant or a special toy for a child, those sorts of things. Very little of the money was spent in ways that people might think are financially irresponsible.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Johnny on the line in Dallas. Hey, Johnny.
Hey. I was just going to say that I had the earned income credit for quite a few years, and I would make, you know, not very much money. It was, low-wage jobs, but we used it to put central heat and air in our house 1 year. And I bought the equipment and put it in myself put down a good chunk of that on a car 1 year. It was very practical expenses in my mind. And we didn't really use it for extravagant purchases at all.
Yeah, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate that, Johnny. It sounds, Sarah, like a lot of the people that you spoke to for the book project.
Yeah, Johnny's story is completely in line with what we were hearing from our families. Spending money in ways that increase the value of your home, that give you access to transportation, that might make it easier to get to work or to have dependable transportation to get to work. So we did see, just as Johnny described, people spending money in ways that help them in the immediate term and might be of longer term use as well.
We know that many of the, not many, but a significant percentage of people who are at the very lowest end of the wage spectrum are unbanked. They do not have bank accounts. How do they manage what can be sometimes thousands of dollars coming in all at once if they don't have bank accounts?
So it depends on how they file their taxes, what options they have available to them. So you can get your taxes direct deposited into your bank account. You can also get sort of prepaid debit cards in a way available from some for-profit tax preparers. And the IRS offers a Direct Express card that you can have your refund put on. So being unbanked doesn't mean you're just going to kind of receive a check that you stuff under a mattress. There are other financial products out there that families are able to use when they have their refund. Although certainly if you want to engage in any longer-term savings, having access to a bank can be really important.
Certainly retailers feel the bump, retailers who deal with a lot of moderate income customers. and they will set up special incentives and deals to make sure that those customers spend the money with them. Are those companies typically giving these low-income Americans a good deal? Are they looking to sort of get as much as they can from them? What have you seen?
Well, there are companies like Walmart, like a lot of used car dealerships, that are very aware that this is a time of money when a lot of their a time of year, excuse me, when a lot of their customers or potential customers have access to a lot of money all at one time. And so they'll offer tax preparation on site, for example, with the incentive that you then spend the money you just got at their store. And I think if they're doing a good job preparing people's taxes and they're offering that tax preparation at a reasonable fee, then maybe people aren't spending any more than they otherwise would at another for-profit tax preparer. I think I would have concerns if people don't really know how to prepare taxes and they're preparing somebody's taxes and not doing a great job, putting lower-income families at risk of getting audited or not getting the refund that they deserve. Families are pretty thoughtful, as we discussed before, about how they want to spend the money, and they do think about it in advance. So if a family is going to a used car dealership to buy a used car, it's usually because they feel like they need a used car. So I don't feel like I'm in the position to say whether or not they need that used car, and whether or not having the tax preparation services there leads them to spend more on a used car than they otherwise would.
Is the money from the earned income tax credit figured in when we look at overall poverty rates in the United States?
It's not. And this is one of the issues that comes in when we look at the poverty rate and we say we're spending all this money on benefits and the poverty rate's not budging. Our programs must not be working. And it's because the way we measure poverty is designed not to take into account those sorts of post-tax and transfers like the earned income tax credit. So we totally miss out on the millions of families that we actually bump over the poverty line through the earned income tax credit. There's an alternative measure of poverty called the supplemental poverty measure, which is not used as widely, but does take into account those other sorts of transfers, and as well as variation in where you live and in likely costs based on your age and those sorts of things. So the supplemental poverty measure takes that into account, but the regular poverty rates we discuss don't. And so we miss out on how many families are helped by programs like the EITC.
Your title made me think about the fact that in American society, pretty much everyone who has a job who is not, you know, Bill Gates, considers himself or herself middle class. And we know this isn't true, but there's something about saying I am part of the middle class that we all sort of want to be able to say.
It's true. And we heard it from our recipients, you know, people who are claiming government benefits every year, but still claiming that identity as a middle-class American. And I remember one mother saying, it's hardest for those of us who are in the middle. People at the bottom get a lot and people at the top have so much, but those of us who are in the middle really scrape by, and this money we get at tax time is really important. And that identity of being in the middle is really important to be able to claim. It makes you feel like you're a regular American. And as we discussed at the top of the show, the fact that the EITC offers that identity to people, or at least doesn't make them sacrifice that identity, is a key part of the benefit of the program on top of the financial aspect.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to David in Garland. Hi, David.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I love your show. I listen to it all the time.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say the earned income credit program, I hope it stay around, because the majority of people I know who have been fortunate to be able to have employment throughout the year and benefit from the check, they use it, you know, to make purchases on new cars or down payments on decent cars. And I've even known some people who put their check together and, you know, three or four people to start businesses. They're a good amount of people who blow the money and do foolish things with it, but still and all, that goes into stimulating the economy that, you know, folks are always talking about. Money being spent is money being spent, whether it's on responsible things or irresponsible things. It does stimulate the economy. And around this time of year, you know, just about in any neighborhood you go in where working class people live, you see a lot of activity for us financially with the local businesses and things. So I hope they keep it around, and it does help motivate people to get those little McDonald's jobs when they know at the end of the year they can get a nice chunk of change. So I think the program is great.
Thanks for your call. Sarah, anything you want to respond to there?
Yeah, I think the caller brought up two important points. One is how this is a reward for work, and it makes those, what he said, little McDonald's jobs feel like they pay more than just that hourly wage that you get. And the other thing is thinking not just about the effect on an individual family, but he talked about how much money this puts back in the community. And, you know, you think about the fact that in Texas, more than 2.5 million people receive the EITC, and that's money that doesn't just go into their pockets, but flows into the community overall. Across the country, almost 28 million people get the EITC. And that's, you know, that's money going into communities, money that people are typically spending, and that does stimulate the economy.
We have an email here with a slightly different perspective that says, this is a farce that has turned into an industry. Some people work a few months per year and then collect as much as $9,000 in EITC. If the government really wants to help the working poor, they should raise the minimum wage and stop subsidizing the workforces of big business.
So the maximum earned income tax credit benefit is $6,000. So it's not possible for somebody to get $9,000 from the earned income tax credit. People's tax refund checks can include other kinds of refunds, like from the additional child tax credit or any over withholding they've made over the year that can boost people's refund checks higher. It's not typically the case that people just work for a few months of a year and get the EITC. So there certainly are cases of that, but that's not the typical EITC recipient. I think there have been arguments and discussions about whether expanding the minimum wage is more important or expanding the earned income tax credit is more important. And people come down on different sides of that debate. Some people say we should pay a living wage no matter what, and we need to increase wages, and that's morally and economically the right thing to do. Other people say there are people who are working minimum wage jobs who we're not as concerned about, sort of the high school student who's just earning some money after school. They might be working a minimum wage job, and it might be less important to us that their wages get higher. So one of the things that has given the EITC broad appeal is the fact that it is targeted at working parents as opposed to getting, you know, those kids with an after-school job.
What about the fact that it comes in one lump sum, and let's say you know, buy that used car or you fix the heater in your house and you have spent the money. A crisis can still arise a few months later. There's no money there. What are the arguments for perhaps spreading out this earned income tax credit in sums that would be divided over the course of a year, monthly or quarterly or something?
So there is policy discussion going on around that option right now. We did used to have what was called the advanced EITC, where families could get some of the money in their paychecks in advance of tax time. That program had very limited usage. However, I think there are ways that you could offer some periodic payments of the earned income tax credit in different ways that might make it a more attractive option to families. Certainly, families often lack emergency savings. And what that means is that when that crisis comes, like you mentioned, families have to spend on credit, they get a payday loan, and they rack up debt. And that means they arrive at tax time not just needing to pay their immediate bills, but to pay back debt and the interest they've accumulated on that debt. So I think there certainly is a case to make for how important it would be to give families more ready access to support around the year to deal with those financial difficulties as they arise, as opposed to having families build up debt and the interest on that debt.
What did you learn from families who had successfully taken at least some of the money from these windfalls and put them away in kind of long-term savings?
So about just less than 20% of the refund dollars that people had were put away in savings at tax time. And when we followed up with families 6 months later, about 7% of refund dollars still were left in savings. So people were putting away money at tax time and using it as that sort of emergency savings or to spend on, you know, to cover little bills from month to month. So families are doing some of that themselves. I think the policy discussion has been, are there ways that we can design the program to facilitate people doing that more easily?
What are the challenges for families of the fluctuating eligibility from year to year? I mean, I gather that you have to have a pretty significant change in income to lose the benefit, but certainly, as you mentioned, people don't necessarily know how much they'll receive.
So I think it can make it hard for families to plan from year to year if they know that check is coming in or not. And it probably is those people who lose eligibility from 1 year to the next are probably experiencing a change in their family. So if you get married, for example, and you now have combined incomes, that could push you over the income limit and therefore you're no longer eligible. Probably the people who are experiencing more regular changes in their eligibility are at the very bottom of the earnings spectrum, or they're kind of at the top for EITC recipients. And so they earn just a little bit too much that 1 year. And because the program phases out pretty gradually, you're not going from, you know, getting $5,000 in the EITC 1 year to getting $0 the next year. You might have only gotten a few hundred dollars 1 year and then you don't get anything the next year. So because there's not kind of a benefit cliff where you go from getting a lot to getting nothing, those families don't experience such an abrupt transition unless it's those cases I mentioned before, like changes in your family.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is my guest. She is Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's also lead author of a new book called It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. If you'd like to join our conversation about the effects of the Earned Income Tax Credit, our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. SMU Summer Youth has hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration opens March 3rd at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Sarah Halpern-Meekin. She's lead author of a new book called It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Sarah, there is this question of why the Earned Income Tax Credit overwhelmingly favors families with children. Certainly, they have greater needs and greater expenses than single working people without children or married working people without children. But is this simply a matter of the affordability of the program and it just wouldn't be feasible to extend it to a greater number of people who aren't actively raising kids?
Well, I think there are two things going on. One is that There are discussions underway about whether and how the EITC should be expanded to people who don't have dependent children, particularly non-custodial parents who might be totally up to date on their child support but can't claim their children as dependents for EITC purposes, and perhaps expanding it to them. So there have been some policy experiments to see if that's possible. I think the other issue is that when we think about government expenditures and those being targeted towards children, we can think about those dollars being invested in kids now and that paying off for all of us over the long term. So children whose families receive more earned income tax credit dollars, say when the EITC is expanded, or in those states that have state-level earned income tax credits on top of the federal earned income tax credit, those children tend to have better health outcomes. They have better educational outcomes. And that pays off for them as individuals, and it pays off for us as a society, because we have kids who are getting more education, who aren't making as many demands on subsidized health insurance, who don't need as many intervention services. And so investing money in kids is a way that we can sort of invest dollars wisely to pay off for the public good.
Are there significant numbers of people, families who qualify for this benefit that don't know about it, don't know how to apply for it?
It's a pretty widely claimed benefit. So the national average is around 79% of eligible people receive it. I checked to see what it's like in Texas out of interest, and it's right around 77%. So very similar to the national average. More than three-quarters of people who are eligible are claiming the benefit. And I think the people who are probably least likely to claim it are people with very low earnings and those people who don't have children. So the refund that they would be getting would be pretty small. So the take-up rate among parents, for example, is really high.
Undocumented immigrant families would not be eligible for this, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about ways that the earned income tax credit affects things that are not tangible. The stress of poverty and of sort of not knowing how you're going to cover that bill ends up affecting a lot of other things that can, you know, fall like dominoes and affect the outcomes for children in particular. Will you talk a little bit about what you learned about the sense of relief, even if it's temporary, for families who receive this money?
It's a huge psychological relief to feel like you can finally get caught up. You can finally get those bill collectors off your back. You can make sure that your rent is paid, that your car insurance is paid, that you can put food on the table. One mother described to us the enormous sense of relief she felt when she walked out of the tax preparer's office knowing that she was going to have the money to avoid getting evicted. So it's an enormous psychological relief to families, and particularly parents feeling like they can be the sorts of parents they want to be. So much of the year they have to say no to buying the kids the things that they want. One mother said, you know, I'm able to provide for my kids' needs, but not their wants. And that's different at tax time. She said she was able to take the kids clothes shopping and let them pick out the outfits that they wanted. She said it might have been a lot more expensive than what I usually would have spent for buying them the cheapest clothes I could get, but they actually got to choose what they wanted and not just what they needed. And so kids get that feeling of getting things that they want, getting things their classmates may have. And that's important to feeling like you're normal. We live in a society that values consumption a lot. And the EITC allows families to consume in the ways they see other families doing and in a way that's not available to them a lot of the year. So it's important to kids. They get, you know, the name brand clothes instead of the store brand clothes. And it's important to parents for feeling like they can finally say yes for once when their kids ask for something instead of always saying no.
Does utilization of the payday lending industry dip in the months immediately following tax filing time?
That's a really interesting question, and I don't know the answer to it, but it makes me want to go do more research.
Well, that's nice to hear. It does seem as if, you know, there could be some way of taking some of this money and making it available to people in the form of something like a payday loan that they're borrowing from themselves.
So there have been proposals to do that sort of thing. Senator Sherrod Brown has proposed that families be able to claim up to $500 of their refund in advance of tax season, and then they would just get a lower refund at tax time. In the book, we suggest the possibility that we create a deferred EITC. So rather than taking the whole lump sum at tax time, families could say, okay, I'll take half of it now, and then I would like half of it available in increments over the rest of the year. If we were really intent on having families do that, we could incentivize that behavior by giving a little bonus to families who defer taking some of their refund until later on in the year. So those are some policy options that have been put on the table that people are discussing now.
I think national unemployment has fallen to something like 5.7%. But of course, the irony of the earned income tax credit is it really does you no good if you have had the misfortune of losing a job.
Absolutely. You know, when times are good. And when times are bad, it just makes it worse because you lose your job and you lose this benefit. We followed up with our families a few years after we had initially interviewed them, and one family had just that experience. When we had first met them, the mother was working as a hospital payroll coordinator. The family didn't have a lot of savings, but she had these detailed plans for how they were going to save their refund in the future, and she had plans for the sort of house they were going to buy in a safer neighborhood where they could take their kids out of the violence that they were experiencing. And when we came back a few years later and talked to her again, she had lost her job, and after her unemployment had run out, she had drained her savings. And because her boyfriend was disabled, he wasn't able to work, but he had also not been able to successfully claim disability. And so she had managed to get a job as a school lunch aide, earning very little just before we had met this second time. But she said, you know, she had lost her job and she also couldn't get a tax refund. So it was a double whammy.
How does the timing of the earned income tax credit work for families who are hoping to send maybe the first generation of kids to college?
So different research has found that families that get that money when their students are finishing high school in their junior and senior year are more likely to see those kids enroll in college. So it does seem to make families perhaps feel more able to pay for college, or it makes the family more secure financially in the short term and therefore doesn't distract the child from graduating from high school or from filling out those FAFSA forms to be able to go to college.
But then age-wise, they're really not dependent children anymore at just the moment that that they're looking to go off to school.
So you are still a dependent child of your parent when you're a student, according to EITC rules. So you're able to be claimed as a dependent child while you're a full-time student.
How politically safe do you think the earned income tax credit is? Is it going anywhere?
Well, I think federally it's pretty safe that it's going to be around. It has faced some more challenges at the state level. Here in Wisconsin, the state EITC was cut in recent years, so it does still exist, but the amount that families are able to get back was cut. So there have been challenges there as states have faced budget shortfalls of the EITC being a place that states look to save some money by limiting or eliminating the program. That said, most states don't have the EITC, so that's not a place where most states go to save money. I think on the federal level, it is safe. The question, the more immediate policy question, is whether the expansions to the EITC that were part of the Recovery Act will sunset in 2017, as they're scheduled to do, or whether those expansions will be made permanent. And so those expansions include higher income limits for married couples, and perhaps most importantly, they include higher EITC benefits for those with three children. So it used to only be that two or more children was the benefit limit, and then it was increased so that those with three children could get higher benefits than those with two children.
You didn't happen to meet anyone who just kept having children to get a higher EITC?
No. And in fact, we asked people about that because we know that there's certainly a perception and a concern that people might do that. And parents laughed at us and they said, one mother said, anyone who does that is not smart because the amount of money it costs you to have a child pay, you know, is far, far and away more than the amount you get from the EITC. So families were very dismissive of that idea and actually said that they would really look down on anyone who is making decisions about having children or getting married, those sorts of things, based on their tax refund check.
Did you find that because there is not a stigma attached to the earned income tax credit, for the most part, that it was easier to get families to be really candid with you about their experiences with it than it would be if you were talking about some other sort of benefit?
We did ask people about other benefits that they received, particularly about welfare. And families were forthcoming with their stories about welfare, although it was clear that it was, you know, a time in their lives since it was all in the past, since they were all working now. But the time on welfare was clearly a time that many weren't proud of. And parents would go to great lengths to really try to explain away their time on welfare and explain how they weren't like other welfare recipients. And we didn't hear them doing that when it came to talking about their tax refund check. I will say, though, that other research that I do is on romantic relationships. And talking to people about money and their finances is actually a touchier subject, I found, than talking to people about their romantic relationships. So money is something that people hold really near and dear to their hearts. And can feel very personal. It's not just dollars and cents.
That's very interesting. Well, it has to do with our values as well and things that we're supposed to be able to, everyone is supposed to be able to handle money and support themselves despite the conditions that might exist around them.
Yeah, and we make judgments about people's deservingness and the decisions that they've made based on what their finances look like. And I think that's why people do try so hard to explain why they were on welfare and how they've, you know, they've worked past that and how terrible it was and they would never go on welfare again. And, you know, on the converse, why they feel like this benefit of the earned income tax credit isn't anything like that. They get it because they're working and because they're parents. And those identities, those labels of being a worker and being a parent are positive ones in our society. And so this is a government assistance program that rewards people for being a worker and being a parent, and people feel good about that.
Sarah, was there anything that you and your colleagues heard in all of these interviews with recipients that took you by surprise?
I think I was really struck by just how detailed people's understandings of their finances were. You know, we sat down with families and really tried to get them to tell us every dollar they had coming in and every dollar they had going out every month, which, if you think about doing that for yourself, is a really difficult task. And often families could do this off the top of their heads. And you think about how many numbers are people are playing with in their heads at any one time. You know, it's exactly how much you have in that checking account and when does your paycheck cash versus when your landlord is going to cash your rent check. And the amount of energy that people have to put in to living on very little is really astonishing. And you understand then why tax time is so big. It's not just so big because of the dollar amount you get, but because of the relief you get from having to think about every dollar and every cent every day.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's the lead author of the new book, It's Not Like I'm Poor, How Working Families Make Ends Meet in a Post-Welfare World. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
KERA is examining the staggering costs of living poor through the lens of the Jubilee Park neighborhood in Old East Dallas. The series is called One Crisis Away Inside a Neighborhood. You can explore it online at jubilee.kera.org. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.